Hi there, and welcome to our podcast, Mindfulness at Work. I'm Cara Pollard.
Hello, and welcome to Mindfulness at Work. I am your host, Cara Pollard, and I'm here with David Gandelman, who is an expert in meditation. David, can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks for having me on the show, Cara. I'm excited to talk with you and all the incredible parents out there.
Excellent.
So I teach meditation mostly online these days with COVID, obviously. I work with an app called Insight Timer, which is a really cool app. If you haven't tried it yet, it's actually the most used meditation app in the world.
Wow.
That's a great platform for getting started, I think, for a lot of people. I host two podcasts. So I have one called Energy Matters, where I interview people, and one called Grounded Sleep, where I hopefully bore you to sleep. So if you're having trouble sleeping, you could check that one out. And then I would say my main focus these days is I have what's called Meditation School, and that's where I teach online over Zoom, and I have a membership area and put all my content there and really engage with my students. So my hands are pretty full with teaching meditation these days. I also do teach at some companies, universities, less so now, but before COVID, you know, a bit more. So I've played in that space as well. And I just love teaching people to calm down.
Yes, I think that we could all use a little calming. We could all use a little more sleep before COVID. And certainly COVID has uncovered how much we are lacking in that area. Tell me what you think the benefits are of meditation and why it isn't something that's just woo-woo and it's really a practice that we all should be engaging in.
Sure. So it really depends what you're looking at healing or accomplishing, because there are, you know, countless different styles of meditation. But I would say more than 80% of people come to meditation because they're anxious and or stressed. But hopefully they get something more out of it than just kind of lowering their anxiety by 20%. But that tends to be the starting point. So, you know, let's just start there. If you're listening to this, if you are a parent, you're probably stressed, you're probably maybe a bit overworked, you're probably anxious, maybe about the kids, about family, about money, about life. So with all of that going on, how do we sit down and turn it off and actually find some inner peace? Because usually what happens is people, they go to meditate, they close their eyes, and all of the outside noise is now on the inside. So they're like, oh, I just brought it with me. I don't like meditating. It makes me more anxious. That happens a lot. So one of the first things I like to tell my students is let whatever is happening to you just arise and teach you. So the benefit of meditation at like a really deep level, I would say, is it's teaching you something about yourself. So let's take anxiety, for example. You close your eyes, you want to meditate, you feel anxious. You're like, all right, David told me to let whatever's coming up teach me. And now all of a sudden, I'm having all of these anxious thoughts and feelings. This isn't teaching me. I don't like it. So what do I do? So what I would say is take that feeling and or that image in your mind's eye and just freeze it for a moment. If we're able to freeze it in time and inspect it a little bit. And what people will notice is anxiety in particular tends to be like the icing on the cake. It's a surface level feeling that's covering up something much deeper. And when we uncover what's underneath anxiety, we might find out that we're just really sensitive to energy. We're sensitive to other people's pain or to stress. We're sensitive to the world and to the media, and it makes us anxious. Or we care so much about our kids or our family that we get anxiety because we want them to be safe. So under that anxiety, it might just turn out that you're a good person.
Exactly. And most of us are, right? And
yes,
I think that's such a beautiful way to break it down. And it it sounds, you've put it in a simplistic way. And to me, if you start to meditate and you're just noticing and freezing in time, kind of your anxiety, that's an awareness. And through awareness comes growth. And it's just teaching us a little bit more about ourselves. And so to slow down and learn about yourself will then help you to change. Because if you don't even know it, if you're covering your anxieties in the busyness of life, what you don't know, you're going to act out anyway, right? So you're going to be acting in a way that's exhibiting that anxiety, and that's going to impact your life in some way, either in your relationships, in a time management standpoint. You can name it, it's going to show up in some way. So you might as well be aware of what your actual thoughts and feelings are, even if you're uncomfortable with them from the start.
Yeah, definitely. And then, you know, that actually, I would say that's the hardest part of starting a meditation practice, is just like starting some exercise routine or a new diet or dating, if you're afraid of dating, or anything in life. The beginning tends to be the hardest part because we're trying to create a new routine and a new pattern and break an old one. And so we're so used to taking any area of our lives where we feel uncomfortable and making ourselves comfortable. It's cold, turn up the heat. It's hot, turn up the AC. I don't like it outside, I'm going inside. You know, it's like every single moment we're avoiding pain and we try to move towards pleasure. And this might sound counterintuitive, but when you start meditating, you actually have to learn how to stop doing that. How to stop doing the pushing and the pulling and trying to manipulate life to always feeling just right, because life is trying to show you something in meditation and you're just going, I don't want it. I don't want it. So the pain or the suffering that we often experience is trying to teach us something so we can grow through it. And we're going, but I don't want to experience you. But life is going, wait, on the other side of this, there's a really deep message and purpose. So if you could just get through that initial discomfort, even if it's boredom, some people sit and meditate and like, oh, this is just boring. Get through the boredom or resistance. Usually people find a lot of resistance. They start thinking about somebody and having an argument in your head with them, or ruminating on something in the past that you're in resistance to. If you can get through that resistance, there's usually a really beautiful answer on the other side. So when you start your meditation practice, it's important to time yourself at first, because what almost always happens is right when we hit a level of resistance, we get up. Oh, my back is itchy. You know, my stomach hurts. I need to go finish the laundry. And we won't even realize we're halfway to the refrigerator before we recognize we jumped out of meditation too early. So if we have a timer that's saying you're not getting up till this bell rings, it's going to make it much easier to get through those first layers of resistance.
Mm-hmm. So I love what you're saying, because it's like any practice that we do. So exercise doesn't feel good the whole way through, right? You know, but we still keep forging ahead. Or doing our bills isn't feeling good halfway through, but you still have to complete the task monthly or however often you pay your bills. And I even heard something that Sanjay Gupta did an interview with the Dalai Lama, who the Dalai Lama has been meditating for decades. And he still finds it difficult at sometimes. And he admitted this to Sanjay. And he then taught him a practice of analytical meditation, where you do focus on a problem, which of course might feel uncomfortable. And we all have to get comfortable with the uncomfortable, just, you know, watching it. But he takes a problem and removes it from himself physically and puts it in a clear box outside of his head. And then he's able to look at it from all different angles. And when he taught Sanjay Gupta from CNN this, that was a way that Sanjay could then engage in meditation. That's the meditation that he goes to. It's the meditation that he likes. His whole family has noticed that he's able to commit to this. My husband was resistant. He does transcendental meditation. Mm-hmm. And he has done it for 20 minutes twice a day for, I think, 4 years now. And I can't believe he's missed maybe five. So no matter where we are, he finds a way to do it. And my kids always say, hey, wait till dad's done meditating to ask him, because the answer will be yes.
Yeah, he'll be in a better space, yeah, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, there's a lot of people do TM in that fashion. You know, Jerry Seinfeld, Howard Stern. There's a lot of celebrities that really love TM. And I think the structure of it is really helpful, mm-hmm. especially for the beginning meditator, because you know, but you do it in the morning, but then by the afternoon, all of that energy is kind of creeped back in. So then you do it again. It really is like an energetic maintenance. We have mm-hmm. to kind of clean our mental and emotional pipes every day.
Yeah. So can you speak about that from a physiological standpoint? Because I think, you know, back to the fact that people think it's woo-woo and they can't do it. Why physiologically is it so important to clean those proverbial pipes? Can you explain that?
Yeah. Well, you know, our neurons, we create patterns with our neurons over time. So if we keep having the same thoughts, thoughts turn into beliefs, and then mm-hmm. beliefs turn into behavior. Right? So usually what we first have is a feeling, and a feeling turns into a thought, then a thought will repeat, and then a thought will turn into a belief, and then into a behavior. But what we don't realize is the feeling that we're having, we tend to just ruminate in the head. Mm-hmm. So we're like, I'm having all of this ruminating thing. I'm having this ruminating thing going on in my head about some past relationship or about why my kids aren't behaving. But what we don't realize is there was a feeling before we had those thoughts, and we were overriding the feeling by trying to figure out how to solve it. Right. So we're figure outing machines. We're at first, our thinking was based on survival, right? Mm-hmm. So how do I kill that tiger? How do I survive the night in this cave? How do I get food tomorrow? How can I figure out where the sun is so I can get to my next location, you know, migrate and hunt? So in our early evolution as human beings, I think most of our thinking into the future and into the past was totally about survival. But now, it doesn't have to be, but it kind of is still programmed that way inside of us. And so everything can feel like this life or death thing in our head that we're trying to figure out. And that stresses the body out. Mm. And it's not even true. So these patterns get created and they're hard to break. So when we meditate, we pull our energy out of the future. We pull our energy out of the past. We bring it into our physical bodies. And now we're kind of reprogramming ourselves. We're breaking those old patterns and we're able to actually be present. So I don't care if you're thinking about nuclear physics or where you're buying the groceries. You're still kind of somewhere out there and not here. And now you need to buy groceries and maybe you need to figure out nuclear physics, but you don't always need to be doing those things. So meditation is, you're unplugging from that and you're resetting your energy and you're letting yourself be present. And unfortunately, that's not something that's valued that much in our society. It's always about producing, mm-hmm. producing. I've taught at a lot of companies where they're like, David, teach our people to meditate so they can produce more. Like, oh, shoot, we got an issue.
Right. And I guess this performative culture that I think is even more prevalent today, particularly in parenting, you know, parents think that their job as a parent is to produce the most effective, performative human being. And actually, you know, all the studies show all of the most important thing in life is connection. And if you're not present, you're not going to be connecting. And that's really what our job is as a society, certainly as parents. And you don't want somebody producing more, because more isn't always better. You want somebody to be producing from a very high level of brain function, right? A very mm-hmm. intellectual level. And without unplugging or kind of clearing out the brain, you're not going to have the capacity to do that, nor will you have the capacity to connect. So tell me about your different types of meditation.
Sure. So, for example, I taught one this morning on Insight Timer, lovely group. It was live. There was over 2,000 students.
Wow. And
It was such a lovely group. And we worked on looking at one issue in our lives that was bringing our energy down in some way that we maybe saw as negative, quote unquote negative. But during the meditation, I had them turn it upside down and go, what's the positive side of this? What is it actually trying to teach you? What is it helping, trying to help you grow into? So most resistance we experience in life is here to help us grow. Mm-hmm. And so that was the meditation we did this morning on visualizing what that was. And we actually started by just looking at our own almost energetic weather. So I like to start meditations this way a lot. So we have two eyes to see out, right? I can see you, you can see me. We see the world of what we'll call matter. For most people in the world, the only things that matter are the things made of matter. And the things that are not made of matter, matter less. So money matters more, love matters less, right? In that kind of equation. When we close our eyes that are trained to see matter, we open our inner eye, we'll call it our mind's eye, and our mind's eye can see into our interior world, can see our energy, can see our emotions, can see our beliefs and thoughts. And so what I like to do with my students in the beginning of a meditation is have them close their physical eyes, open their mind's eye, and take a look at the energetic weather that they're experiencing. So this morning, this afternoon, this evening, as you meditate, is it rainy? Is it stormy inside your space? Is it cloudy and you can't see your answers? Are there huge clouds of negativity or confusion? Or is it a super sunny day? And you know, when you're on the beach and the sun is shining on the ocean and there's almost like this path that it creates of mm-hmm. light on the water in front of you, is it one of those days where you can clearly see your path? Or is there some energy that you have to get through because it's kind of a difficult weather pattern? Or maybe a really bad one. Maybe there's a freaking hurricane. Maybe it's a level 4 tropical storm or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
First thing we have to do, so I like to break it down into 4 steps. I'll just say them first and then walk through them briefly. So find it, feel it, face it, heal it. So find it, let's check out the weather. How do I feel? What's going on in my space right now? Let me see, and then let me start to feel it. Okay, so the weather doesn't look good, now I'm feeling it. So let's identify the feeling. Right? So what form of negativity, if there is some, is it? Is it anger, depression, sadness, apathy, despondency, anxiety, stress? There's a very long menu of mm-hmm. human experiences here that we tend to have in meditation. So we find it, and then we have to face it. So where did it come from? Where is this anxiety coming from, or this stress? Really look at it with a clear vision and not have any preconceived notions, and ask the difficult questions and let it almost open and unfold in front of you. A lot of people are not willing to really face what they're going through because it's uncomfortable. So we find it, we feel it, we face it, and then we heal it. So the number 4, that's kind of the big one here. Mm-hmm. And that can be 1,000 different techniques. Just as an example, sometimes maybe we put what we're working on in a bubble in front of us, like you were saying the Dalai Lama was teaching, and we really look at it and then watch the negativity drain off of it. Mm. Or perhaps we feel the energy drain off our bodies and almost go down into like a shower drain. Perhaps we bring up a memory that caused a deeper layer of this feeling. So maybe you're like, I'm anxious about work, I'm anxious about money, I'm anxious about my kids, but the deeper you go, you realize, oh, there's actually a memory from my childhood. My parents were anxious, I absorbed that anxiety, and I made it my MO. And there's a real deep memory and programming there that makes me anxious all the time. It's not even about what I thought it was about. So we might have to go that deep to heal it. Mm-hmm. So we find it, we feel it, we face it, and then we heal it. And then number 5, bonus one, maybe we see our next step, right? Mm-hmm. So, all right, I've healed this anxiety on my chest that's been sitting on me for a week. Now what?
Right.
A lot of people stop there, but I love the now what. So what's my next step? Is it to help somebody else heal anxiety? Is it to write a book? Is it to go play with my kids? Is it to go outside and let the sun just shine on my face and enjoy life in this moment? Is it to be creative? Mm-hmm. Is it to, you know, balance my finances here and stop avoiding them? So in meditation, after we tend to work through some layers of energy, that's when our answers come. And I always tell my students that our answers are born out of energy. So people will come to me and say, David, give me my answers. You know, how do I fix this? Or why am I stuck here? What should I do with my life? Should I marry this person? Should I move? Should I build a business? But what they don't realize is there is no right answer until they work through the energy. And that's what they want to avoid. That's why we go to a psychic, right? Hey, I don't want to have to deal with all the pain in my heart to find my soulmate. So just tell me who it is and when they're going to show up.
Right, right. It's so funny that you say that because I work with people. I'm a business coach, but I'm also a parent coach. And so a lot of people say, I just need the how. Well, you know what? There is no how, because every time you come up with a how, you might get thrown a curveball and you'll have to readjust, right? So people ask me, you know, can you tell me how to make my kid behave? They come to me to coach in that way. And then halfway through, they kind of act surprised and they say, I didn't know this was going to be so much about me. Well, yeah, for all the reasons you just said, if your parents dumped their anxiety on you, that's what you're doing to your child. So recognize the energy you're bringing them, heal it, and change it so that you're not doing the same thing that was done to you. And I also just absolutely love how you used the image of, you know, you have two eyes to see out. And you ask people to take their two eyes and go within and see what the energy is. I always tell my parents, you know, look at your thoughts from a bird's eye view. But I really like the way you just explain that better. You know, you're seeing on the inside, seeing those thoughts. And those thoughts really do become patterns. And even the best psychologist, last year we lost two people who died by suicide who were experts in psychology in their field right around November, I think, which was Suicide Awareness Month. And it just showed me how much our thoughts can hijack our brain for people who know better, who know that this could be happening. You know, so doing a meditation practice and really recognizing those thoughts is imperative to our survival.
It's not uncommon for academics and intellectual type people to be depressed. And I've seen this a lot. I remember I had a philosophy professor in college. I thought he knew everything. The way he spoke was like Immanuel Kant writing a book. It was just like off the cuff. It was incredible. But then I got to know him personally. I could tell he was depressed about his relationships in life, his personal relationships. And I thought, how could this philosopher who's so incredible, it's the number one philosophy program in the country, how could he have such a hard time with the everyday stuff? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if you're literally as smart as Einstein. If you're completely identified with your thoughts as who you are, and the stories that those thoughts tell you. It's like watching a movie and you're experiencing this movie on the screen of your mind's eye, and you just, every emotion you see on the screen, you become, every story you become. You know how when the movie ends, you walk out of theater, you're like, where was I for 2 hours? I was just bawling, crying alongside of this actor. You know, that's what's happening inside of our heads all day long. And if you don't meditate or find some way to separate your consciousness from your thoughts, it's going to create misery because those thoughts will never end. They'll just keep telling you stories. Right. Sometimes they'll be positive and sometimes negative. So meditation is about creating space between your awareness and your thoughts. And so the thoughts that you're having, they're a function of the brain, right? They're there to help you navigate life, but they've become the master of you instead of the servant. Mm-hmm. Instead of using your thoughts to make money or to build a bridge or whatever it is, those thoughts are now using you and they're feeding off of you, off of your energy endlessly. So we have to break that pattern for me, it's by meditating.
Yes, that's great. What brought you to your meditation practice personally?
Yeah, so I was 16 my brother came home from college. He said, "You never read, David," which was true. And he dragged me to the bookstore. I just happened to pick up The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle, which is a beautiful meditation book. Highly recommend it for anyone starting out. And literally like a few pages in, he said, you know, most human beings spend their entire lives projecting into the future and projecting into the past and are rarely in this moment. And just, it's like a light bulb went off inside me, and I started meditating a lot just from that point on. So although I said like 80% of people come to meditation through the door of anxiety or stress, for me, it was actually just reading a line in a book.
Wow.
And it was like something deep that was waiting to awaken in me. It did. And I never looked back. You know, I went and lived, I got a degree in philosophy. I lived in the Himalayas in India, studying all different various forms of meditation and spirituality, and then eventually started teaching it. So that's kind of the short, short version. It's not that easy for everyone. I know.
Right. To read a line in a book and change your life is really, pivotal, but I'm glad you did, because I can tell that you're a gift to your students and to the world. You. So, you just have such a beautiful presence about you, and, I really love it. So
thank you.
Can you tell me a success story from maybe a person who was a professional or somebody that you really helped to teach meditation to that were able to implement change into their life?
Yeah, sure. And hopefully by now there are thousands of those students who are doing it, all to varying degrees, of course. Mm-hmm. So I don't want anyone to get the idea here that you meditate and then the biggest problem in your life is solved tomorrow. Sometimes we do it in inches and it takes years. And sometimes we read a line in a book and something awakens in us, and then everything in between. And I've done the really long work too. There are issues in my life I spent years working on, inch by inch, day by day. One in particular, well, let me tell you a failure story and a success.
Love it. Okay.
let's start with the failure. I had a young man come to me and he came for a one-on-one session with me, and I said, "What is it that you want? What do you want to work on?" And he said, "I want to be famous." And you know, I was living in LA, and I was like, "Oh, not surprised. Okay. Why do you want to be famous?" "Because I want to help the world." "All right, great. How do you want to help the world?" "With my music." "Awesome. Okay. What have you written? What kind of music do you do?" "I haven't written any yet." "Okay." So then I said to him, "Well, let's just get a little bit more honest here. Why do you really want to be famous? I want you to close your eyes and feel into this. What is it that you're trying to get out of that?" And he said, "To be validated and to be seen." Mm. I said, "Okay, so you really want to be validated and be seen by others. What does that have to do with helping them?" And he said, "Well, nothing, I guess, on the face of it." "That doesn't mean you can't become famous and help other people, but you want to work through that energy so that you do it for the right reasons." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Listen, if I was to wave my magic wand, which I can't do, but if I was to, and take you and put you on the top of Mount Everest from the base, right? Make you super famous, you wouldn't be able to handle the altitude. If someone dropped you off at the top of Mount Everest from a helicopter, you would die from the altitude sickness and lack of oxygen going up that quickly." And I was like, "And that's what you're asking me, and you're asking of yourself and of what you're asking of life. And that's going to bring you lots of pain. If you can climb up yourself, you're going to be able to handle the change in altitude, but you have to do the inner work to do that. Otherwise, maybe you'll become a narcissist or a power hungry person or greedy. Right? Or total misery and addicted to drugs and alcohol, like a lot of celebrities." And he sat there and he said, "No, I just want to be famous." I was like, "Well, it's great to work with you." And yeah, that was the one and only time. So I would say that was a failure on one level, maybe he got it. I don't know. It's been some years. on another level, great teaching experience for me. Like I got to really learn something by looking at that. And let's go to a success one. Mm-hmm. I was working with a woman in her 40s and she wanted to use meditation to help her in all of these different areas of life. And I asked her, are you in a relationship? And she goes, oh, no, I'm not interested in those. So she's like, I want to do this in my career and that in my career. Help me with this and that, David, in my career. And I said, well, how come you're never in a relationship? She goes, I'm not interested in that. So we go a little bit deeper and we hit on a really deep, deep well of pain. And it was the first time in her life she admitted to somebody that she had abuse in childhood, like very, very severe abuse. And in that moment, she realized that maybe she did want a relationship and she just covered it up because there was so much pain around the possibility. And I remember her messaging me the next day saying that she had met somebody after decades of being alone.
Wow.
Some guy literally walked up to her, asked her out, and she said, yes, that was that. So I don't know where it went from there, but it was a success story because she was able to really see her own pain, express it, which is the hardest part, to somebody else, get that shame and that guilt off of her. And then on the other side of that energy, create something of value. So you can't just meditate the rest of your life. You have to actually create, right? You want to do something, be creative, help others. So kind of contrasting stories there, but both different kinds of pain, forms of pain that then there's an opportunity, or there is in each of those to grow into something deeper. So I always like to tell my students, last thing here, wherever that pain point is, wherever that stuckness, that resistance is, that is where the growth is. Mm-hmm. And we all know that intellectually, but like really facing that is where the gold is. And we face it partially in meditation.
Yeah, that's such two wonderful stories and so true that we have to do the work. And nobody wants to do the work. People all want to be seen and validated. But if you do the work and if you see and validate yourself, you're more likely then to be able to, what your success story was, that woman, she cleaned up that energy, right? And so when she cleared that energy, there was an openness about her that then was able to let someone else in. Without cleaning up that energy, she would have remained closed. So
I want to be clear that she probably will need or did need therapy probably for years in counseling. So it's not like a one-off thing.
Right.
And we can't do it all ourselves. Sometimes we need a team of people to help us. All coaches, guides, teachers, healers. I do. I use a whole team of people to help me. And so this, maybe that was just a, lit the fire under the rocket.
Right.
But she definitely was going to need more care and attention.
Yes. I mean, she experienced trauma. And so, we know from ACEs that if you experience trauma, you can be a successful person in society, but it's because of all those positive times that you sought help or, talked to somebody about your shame or engaged in a meditation practice. But I think that all of what we're talking about reminds me so much of the work that working parents have to do to clear that energy, to be in the present moment. And even I have to talk to parents about the energy they bring to their interactions with their kids. It's so important. They don't understand that if their kid is having a temper tantrum, if they respond to them in an energy that's like a temper tantrum, either with anger or begging and cajoling to stop, they're going to both remain in that energetic state for a lot longer than if they came to them with a sense of calm. And it's kind of okay that you're having this temper tantrum because it's not going to derail who I am. I think is of the utmost importance for me to teach, but yet it's such a hard practice I'm asking them to be a saint. It's so hard to keep your energy in that copacetic state. But one way is to have a mindfulness or meditation practice that helps to, for you to be able to go there. I mean, I know that I think some expert in meditation was saying that he had a colicky baby and completely forgot. You know, he was so anxious, but then he just started breathing to calm himself down, and it immediately calmed the baby down. And then it was like a light bulb went off in his head. The calmer he is, the calmer the baby will be.
You know, it is. Some people might not like this analogy, but I don't know if you know the dog whisperer, Cesar Millan.
Yes, yes.
TV show. And he always, whether you like him or not, I like him. He always says, I don't train dogs. I rehabilitate dogs and I train owners. And I think there's something similar in parenting is a lot of, with animals, a lot of the anxiety in the animal or the aggression comes from them feeling the energy of their owner and the uncertainty in their owner. And so a child, you know, especially in those first 5 years, is such a sponge. So if you're anxious, if you're uncertain, if you're confused, if you're in pain, wow, is that going to have an effect on them? But then also all the way up through teen years. So this is the hardest part of parenting. Everybody wants techniques and how-tos and strategies, but rarely does someone want to recognize, oh, it's mostly just my energy.
Right. It is. It's the energy that you say to your teenager without saying it. I'm expecting you to mess up and fail at every moment because I have so much fear that I'm bringing. So I'm expecting you to be stoned. I'm expecting you to get D's. And what happens, it's almost like they don't realize that that energy is first. And then the kid reacts to that and lives up to what their image is. And yeah. It's so true. I can't even, and you know, I have to work for weeks and weeks on end for parents to clean that energy up.
Yeah. And even if, for example, if there's some lie in the family or mom and dad are fighting, even if it's not in front of the kids, they know, they can feel, I mean, that child, if your mother was inside of your body, they can feel how you feel just as much as you can feel how they feel. They might not express it as much.
Right.
So this is the hardest part. Shifting our energy, shifting it from the inside out, and our answers come from energy. So if you want answers around your kids, you might have to start to shift your energy. Now, that being said, maybe like this is true 80% or 90% of the time, and then there's some extreme cases. So if a child has Down syndrome or is on the spectrum or some severe depression, there's something chemically off. Now, changing your energy will help for sure, but you know, may not be enough. Now you're going to need a team of people and some other strategies. But I would say kind of in the normal, let's say, quote unquote, normal range of human behaviors, I think shifting your energy will take you pretty far.
Right. Because your kids, like you said, they know if a fight occurred in a room before you got there, they know if there's energetically a problem with you and your partner. They even know sometimes your thoughts. And I tried to work with my clients about this. You know, we talked about how thoughts become patterns. And I always ask my clients, I start with, what are you thinking? What are those stories you're telling yourself? How are you berating yourself and negating what you've done throughout the day? Can you this week go and go home and tell me what your thoughts are? And at least once a day, give me a rock star parenting move that you did. And one client kept telling me, I just can't do it. I feel conceited. And so I kept working with you know, she was religious. I said, could you imagine God telling you what your rock star moment was and think of it that way? She said, no, I'm not into it. I can't do it. And I said, okay. And then she called me like 6 months later in an emergency situation saying that her daughter had a severe lack of self-esteem. And I couldn't tell her in that moment because I had to work with her and care for her. But that thought process that she was doing to herself was energetically being felt and passed on to her daughter. And so again, we had to start with her own thoughts so that her daughter could gain some self-esteem. So it's very real, and it's just hard to explain.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not surprised at all that her daughter was having self-esteem issues. I think there's a particularly close bond between a mother and daughter, and the energy that flows through that pair is really, really potent and also so sensitive sometimes. I've worked with students who their mother said or did something to them 30 years ago, mm-hmm. and they're still holding it right on the front of their chest, and it is a filter they see everything through. I do want to just back up and say, when I mentioned Down syndrome, I used to run a meditation school in Hawaii on the top floor of this two-floor building, and underneath us was a school for children with Down syndrome. And they were the most sensitive kids I had ever seen in my life. Maybe they couldn't speak, some of them couldn't speak, some could. But even if they couldn't, they were so sensitive to energy. It was from a mile away, they could sense what feeling you were having, and they would respond. Sometimes if someone was in a negative state, one of the parents, the kid would really throw a tantrum, and you can't physically communicate with them all the time. And so you have to shift your energy. So then they shift their energy.
Yeah.
And I would watch this happen. Some parents get it, some not. And the really good caretakers and teachers with them would really get that concept, that shift your energy, and they're going to feel that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What a great example. And that's so true. There's more sensitive, intuitive people among us. And a lot of times they're people with a disability of one type, and their intuition and their sensitivity is at a level that we don't even
comprehend.
Yeah. Right. And I love your analogy to Caesar. You know, it really is about the owner or the parent and their energy. I'm just marveled. I don't watch him often, but once in a while, I'm marveled at the way he has no fear and has command. And it's an inner knowing, I think, that I often ask parents, if they come to me and say, you know, I really have a problem with my kid smoking pot. I don't want him to smoke pot because he's doing it too much, but I kind of wish he could do it in a normal way. And so I say, well, what's a normal way? And if he's smoking pot too much, it means there is no normal. So they want this, they're grieving this lack of normalcy. And when they go to their kid in this conflicted way, again, energetically, the kid doesn't know that it's a stone boundary. So you have to know within yourself, if you really don't want him to smoke pot, you've got to establish that. It can't be just, I just wish you could do it once a week and not every day. I mean, that doesn't work. It's not the as is, it's not what's happening. So that inner knowing, like, nope, you just are a person who can't smoke pot because it affects you in the way that it does. You know, if they impart that to their kids, then the kids know what to expect and what the expectations are. It's the fact that we have these, you know, dual desires and we're not clear about them ourselves that gets kind of the interactions messed up.
You know, I smoked a lot of weed when I was a teenager. I kind of turned out all right.
<don't know. laughs> Right.
But probably out of peer pressure, out of just enjoying unplugging from the endless responsibilities of school. And luckily I did grow out of it because I found other passions, but I think a lot of teenagers are suffering from anxiety, and that's the only way they know how to deal with it. And pressure from school, right? All that social pressure. So as a parent, I think it's important to be that guiding light. Say, look, this is what it looks like to be grounded.
Right.
One of the things I think parents, and by the way, I did work at a Waldorf school for a number of years, teaching, working with kids. So I have a fair amount of experience working with kids. I've done a lot of work with kids, but I'm not a parent. But what I think is important is that you become a guiding light for your kids, and not always be, let's say, quote unquote, in their space. Mm-hmm. So when a child hits those teenage years and sexuality starts to arise immediately, it's like mom, dad, get away. And you take that as like a slight against yourself. Well, they don't want to be around me. I'm not cool anymore. It's like, no, they're growing into sexuality. It's awkward. Now they're with their friends. They need space. And what a lot of parents, they have a hard time transitioning, I've seen, in that moment, and like really giving their kids the right amount of space so that they can feel independent, but also still being there so the kid doesn't go like way off the rails and, you know, off into some deep drugs or some serious irresponsible behavior. Now, some kids naturally, right, they're just more responsible and they won't. And other kids, they need a shorter leash. So it's up to the parent to find what that range is. But I think a lot of parents just treat their kids how their parents treated them. Mm-hmm. And they're not being sensitive to the needs of this specific individual. And I like to look at it from a spiritual perspective. So I like, you know, look at the spirit inside of that body. There might be a really big old soul sitting in that little tiny body, and you're talking to it like it's 10 years old. It should be talking to it like it's 10,000 years old and
Show
it a different kind of spiritual respect, and then maybe they'll respond differently to you. So can you see that beyond your child's physical body? Just like, you know, when we fall in love and we're all in that honeymoon phase, like, oh my God, he sees me or she sees me, you know, oh, this, they're the first person to ever see me. That feeling of being seen. Well, it's kind of the same with your kids, right? They want you to see them. They want to be seen. That's why there's this obsession with Instagram and TikTok and Facebook. Everybody wants to be seen, but they're not, you know, it's a shallow version of that.
Right.
But can you see them? Can you really look at them and see them for the spirit that they are inside their body? I think that can give a great healing to almost anybody and to shift a dynamic.
Yeah, it is actually the key to parenting, right? To recognize that you're not supposed to constantly be correcting and teaching. You're supposed to be recognizing who that soul, that 10,000-year-old vessel of wisdom that can teach you so much about yourself. If you don't come up against that resistance, your ego, whatever it is, that's telling you, I know the right answer for my kid, when in fact, I mean, my kids have taught me more about life than I ever could have shown them. And that openness has just been my biggest gift from them to me. So, but I wasn't always that way. I tried to do a lot of my, the reason I am a parent coach is I was trying to do a lot of my own healing on their back. So my mom left me for a couple years when she was younger. My parents were divorced. So my goal in life was to have a very tight-knit, good family. And little did I realize that the reason I wanted that, my desire for that, was to heal myself. And so when my kids were teenagers and they were like, back off, I was like, wait, but we're a one big happy family. And they're like, yeah, we are, now get out, you know?
You're suffocating me.
Yes. And so that realization, while it was painful, it led me to a great growth and a great opportunity to have a deeper relationship with my kids. And I told them all, like, I know I've messed you up, just tell me how and and we'll work through it, you know, because it is, yeah, it is what it is. So
we all get that. We all get that. And it's part of life. Otherwise, you wouldn't have any fuel to grow. And
right.
As an adult, you'd have no war stories to tell. My family are immigrants, so I'm first generation. They came from Russia, Belarus, when just a few years before I was born. So my first language was Russian. My parents didn't speak any English, and so that kind of immigrant, hardworking, we stick together through anything and everything, make sure we survive kind of energy. And as good as it was to a certain point, I also had to break through that because there was a limitation, which was like, we always have to stay really close together and you have to work really hard for money.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, how about we could have some space? I moved to Hawaii in India. And I realized you don't have to work so hard for money. You don't have to scrub floors, you know, that you can use your mind in different ways and be creative about it. So there was some inherent limitations from that immigrant energy that I had to grow through as I became an adult. And I don't blame my parents for it in any
way.
I kind of added onto what I already had.
Yeah. Because your parents don't, I like to say, you know, they don't know what they don't know, right? They didn't know any different. Yeah. But how do they feel, David, about your wide reach and about the fact that you travel and you have 2,000 people that, you know, just before this podcast on with you? Do they feel very vulnerable or?
Well, today was kind of an interesting day because there was on the front of the app on the website. It was a picture of me next to Russell Brand and Elizabeth Gilbert and one other teacher, Sarah Blondin, who's phenomenal. And so Elizabeth Gilbert wrote Eat, Pray, Love.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was particularly today, yesterday was kind of a moment of, I was getting all these messages like, holy cow, whoa, look at that. We thought you were a failure. No, I'm just kidding. But my mom in particular loves it. She loves spirituality and meditation. So it's like, I couldn't do anything better. But she didn't come to it until after I did and I started teaching her meditation maybe like 10 or so years ago. Now she's really into it. So it was a little bit like I taught her and brought her into that and watched a cool shift. My dad, an old school engineer, designs buildings. And so I don't know if he quite sees it yet. For him, the calculus might be a little bit more, as long as you're making a good living, you're happy, you're safe, that all is well.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we, just like that, you know, Maslow hierarchy of needs, we all need to make sure we get those survival needs met. And for immigrants without money, that could be a much bigger piece of the pie than for some Americans, for example, who were born into money or who were always middle class or didn't have to worry about it. So, but then after I kind of had to outgrow just that level of need, all right, there's more than just paying the bills and eating food. There's emotional need, there's spiritual needs. I want to be creative. I want to have a vision. I want to help people. And that I kind of honestly had to teach myself, and maybe learned from like thousands of hours of listening to podcasts, of watching other teachers, of following people that I thought were doing something really cool with their lives. And then slowly, I had to teach myself business. I read all hundreds of books, listened to countless podcasts on business, and just had to develop my own style and structure and hire people. And all of that took a lot of work. But yeah, is a part of my growth as a person. So I think my parents appreciate my entrepreneurial spirit alongside of that too.
Yeah. Well, I do too, because again, you just offer so many things to so many people. So besides Insight, is that the app that you
Insight
said?
Insight Timer.
Where else can people find you? And can you give us a little bit of information about the different meditations? I went to your website and I love that, like, you have one on dating and one on business and one on stress or whatever. Can you tell us?
Sure. So I think the best place, if you want to do some work with me, would be to come to meditation school. It's just meditationschool.us. And so I teach a few times a month live, and I bring in other teachers. So we have a hypnotherapist who a couple times a month guides hypnotherapy journeys, which is not something I can do. So I thought she would be a great addition. I love like that when you get to lay down and go really deep with. And then inside of the membership, I have courses on healing past relationships, on letting go of all sorts of different kinds of energies, on the fundamentals of meditation, on sleep. So I do try to tackle as many topics as possible. I even started doing a live Zoom speed dating night. I just started that. We just had our first one, really, really fun. And it's great for getting out of your shell if you're trying to date during COVID. I don't know why I did it. I just had a random inspiration and I just threw it up there, and I had to close the registration because so many people were trying to sign up. I couldn't handle the numbers.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So one of my things is, after studying in India, a very traditional Vedantic philosophy and style, when I started to learn more about myself, I realized I like entrepreneurship. I've had a hard time with rejection and heartbreak and relationships. You know, there's all these other areas of life that they didn't teach me about in India that were almost like, doesn't matter, don't bother. Only this one thing matters. And everything matters in life. And so I like to take meditation and apply it to every single part of life that feels relevant to you. So whatever you're working on, that's what's important. It's not what I say is, or the Dalai Lama says is important, or anybody else. If you're like, every morning I wake up and I'm ruminating on a heartbreak, then focus on heartbreak and get the healing you need and do meditations on it. If you're always in this poverty mindset, there's never enough money, there's not enough time, focus your meditations on that and start to shift that in your life. Because what we're really looking for is balance. I think happiness is an expression of balance. Mm-hmm. So all of those needs are met on every level. The artist in you, the explorer, the healer, the lover, the creator. I'm writing a book about this now, actually, about all of these different styles. And the spiritual part of us, all of these parts of us needs fulfillment. So use meditation to help fulfill yourself in every area of your life, and that balance will bring happiness, not some solution to an impossibly complex equation. Mm-hmm. It's really, I think it's finding balance and fulfillment, and it's different for each of us, and it's different in different phases of life. So for me, finding fulfillment and being a parent is not the phase I'm in yet in life, but it might be for you. But then you might grow out of that phase, and your kids go off to school, they grow up, and there'll be a new phase for you.
Right. Yeah, so true. And what a great way to end. I think that meditation brings balance to your life. And it's certainly in my audience, to working parents, it could add a lot of balance to your life if you engage in a practice, because we, from you, now know all the benefits of meditation. So thank you so much for being here. I'm going to put in the notes where people can find you. And it was just a pleasure talking with you.
Tara, it's such a pleasure being here. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Mindfulness at Work. If you felt inspired by our conversation, we hope you'll share our podcast with your friends and colleagues.